The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I am sincerely sorry for being late. But the good news is that Phil Gavorovich is behind me, and he's following me. And so if you decide to buy a book, buy his book today. He is a wonderful writer. He's been doing great work. I'm a big admirer of his. And I'm not in the habit of pitching other writers' works, but one of the problems when you write fiction is that when great nonfiction, sometimes fiction pales beside great nonfiction. And Phil's work today is a lot more relevant to where we are in some ways than my latest book. So if you have to decide what to do with that $25, go ahead and give it to his cause. It's his last two books are just really speak to where we are as a country and where we are as a planet. And they speak to what we need to do collectively. My latest book, I know you want to hear about The Color of Water, and we'll talk about that in the last 2.5 seconds of this. Actually, I'll speak about it now so you'll be happy. The Color of Water is, my mother's still alive. She's 88 years old. She lives in near Trenton, New Jersey. She is doing fine. She lost one of her sons. My older brother Billy died 2 years ago here in Philly. Other than that, my mother's doing fine. Do I know my Jewish family? Some of them I do know. Some I don't. Does it matter? No, not really. I am very proud of my Jewish background. I'm very proud of my African American history. But you know, I'm not Barack Obama. I'm just a writer who wrote my story. And it happened to come at a time when people were open to hearing that story. I'm sure that my story as a mixed race person, as a black person who has a Jewish background, is not unique in the cone of history. It just so happened that I wrote the book at a time when America was prepared to hear it. And I'm delighted that so many people have read it. I'm flattered that it's compared to some of the great works that have preceded it, and I'm delighted that it continues to sell and is read in schools all across the country. And I have a brand new Subaru. How do you like that? And I'll leave time at the end to answer questions that you might have about The Color of Water, and just spend a few minutes talking about my newest and latest. My second book was called Miracle at St. Anna. And Miracle at St. Anna was about, thank you, that's my cousin over there. Miracle at St. Anna was about was a novel based on the 92nd Infantry Division, which fought in Europe during World War II. And the book was partly inspired because when I saw and read so much about World War II, you know, the Band of Brothers and blah, 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 I never saw any black people. I had an Uncle Henry who was, when I was a boy, he used to say, and he used to drink that joy juice, you know, he used to, in his parlor in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. And he used to say, boy, when we was, you know, the Italians, they loved us. When we were in Italy during the war, they loved us. And then he launched into this story about, you know, the war and blah, blah. And of course, we just didn't pay him any attention at all. But later on, I became curious after Uncle Henry passed away, and I started investigating the whole business of what World War II meant. Initially, my interest was in the Holocaust for personal reasons. And then I started reading more and more about the black soldiers that served in Europe. And I came across information about the 92nd Infantry Division, which were 15,000 African Americans who fought in Italy during World War II. They fought against German General Smiling Albert Kesselring, one of Hitler's most trusted generals, and the fierce 148th Brigade Division that he commanded in Italy, 148th Panzer Division that he commanded in Italy. They were very, very hardened, seasoned soldiers. And America went and dropped 15,000 members of its, quote-unquote, Negro problem in the midst of what essentially was an Italian civil war. So I wrote the book. 8 people read it, and I have 11 brothers and sisters, so, you know, even they didn't get to. I sold about 70,000 copies, and it did okay, but it kind of vanished from the... It dropped right after 9/11, and so no one paid that much attention to it. But about 2 years ago, filmmaker Spike Lee called me and said he was interested in doing a movie based on the book. And so we ended up working together. I wrote the script for it, and the movie comes out in October on Disney. It's being released by Disney Touchstone. Disney, the corporate entity of homemade, you know, prefabricated goodness. So that movie comes out in October. I think Spike did a very, very good job with it. I wrote the script, and it was very hard work. Spike was very demanding. A lot of rewrites, a lot of changes. It has 3 different types of casts. There's a German cast that speaks German, Italians that speak Italian, and African Americans and white Americans that speak English. It's 1 hour and 47 minutes long. My newest book is called Song Yet Sung. And thank you very much. Thank you. I love you. I love you. I do. Don't you hate when people say I love you? I say it in Hollywood all the time. You see, and that's the kiss of death, by the way. You say I love you. That means, you know, don't let the dog hit you where the dog should have bit you or whatever. In any case, Song Yet Sung is about, Song Yet Sung happened, it's about a runaway slave on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And it basically happened when I was down on the Eastern Shore. I was basically trolling around trying to get, I wanted to write another historical novel, and I was very interested in Abraham Lincoln. But as I started to, my man Abe, that's my man, you know, Abe, the hip hop king. Anyway, I was down on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and basically I couldn't get any traction trying to write about Abraham Lincoln, partly because Abraham Lincoln was a great writer himself. And anyone who's read Carl Sandburg's book about Abraham Lincoln, his 2-volume work, I don't think there's anything that needs to be said that could be said any more eloquently than Carl Sandburg said. And so I basically got depressed and just left it alone. So I was driving down on the Eastern Shore of Maryland trying to figure out a way to write about slavery that wouldn't be, you know, this pedantic, you know, oh God. So I saw this sign that said Harriet Tubman's birthplace, like 10 miles. And so I just basically followed the sign until I came to a field, and the big corn stalks, you know, were there. And way, like, you know, half a mile away, you could see this tiny little house. And I took a look around, and I said, there's a story here. Because the sign said, you know, Harriet Tubman and Moses of her people led 300 people to freedom. I mean, there were, what, 150 people here? I mean, if 10 of us got out and walked down, we're in Philly, right, Vine Street, you know, people would say, where are you guys going? We're all 10 of you. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're white or black. I mean, if you saw 20 of us walking down the street together, people would say, where are you going? I mean, is it a marathon or something? You know, hoagies or something? So it occurred to me, how did this woman do it? How did she fit? So I started reading. There are 2 or 3 good biographies of Harriet Tubman. One is written by Catherine Clinton, and there's a couple other good ones. And one of the things I came away with after reading those books was that Harriet Tubman was a dreamer. She got struck in the head as a child, and so she had some kind of sleep problem where she would just instantly drop to sleep and sleep for 5 minutes and then just wake up instantly and, you know, and be fine. I have a 14-year-old who does that too. But I was fascinated with the whole business of her dreaming, and she would dream, and then when she woke, if she was leading a troop of people to freedom, she would have instincts. She would have dreams that would foretell problems, like don't take that train, don't move yet, hold, move, and so forth. And so I took that notion and implanted it into the head of a 19-year-old who was running away. And that's basically all I took from Harriet Tubman in terms of her biography working its way into the book Song Yat Sung. Song Yat Sung is about a 19-year-old woman who dreams of the future. And the future she dreams of is one that is very depressing for her. She dreams of Negro men dressing as boys their entire lives, and black children running from books like they were poison, and men running around in garish costumes playing sporting games for more money than anyone can imagine. And she dreams this, and these dreams are very confusing to her. But she has these dreams in captivity, and she tells these dreams to an old woman with whom she is chained. And the old woman, her name is the Woman with No Name. And the Woman with No Name turns out to be one of the key figures in what was known as the gospel train. Slaves didn't refer to the Underground Railroad as the Underground Railroad. They referred to it as the train or the gospel train. And the Woman with No Name happened to be a key figure in the gospel train. And so as she's chained to this woman, she says to the woman, "I've been dreaming." And so the woman says, "Well, tell me your dreams." But the character, Liz, is afraid to tell her dreams to this woman because she's chained in a room of 19 slaves. And there was no trust amongst slaves. There was no trust amongst captives. And she didn't know whether, you know, someone could trade your life for a piece of bread. She was afraid to tell the woman her dreams. The woman says, "Well, I'll tell you what, if you tell me your dreams, I'll tell you the code." And so Liz says, "What's the code?" And the woman begins to tell her a cryptic bunch of messages, sentences, that were the keys to the Underground Railroad, like the find the blacksmith, he's doing marriages these days, the wagon wheel is tied to the double wedding rings, and so forth. These phrases that seem to mean nothing. And as she tells Liz these phrases, Liz, in exchange, tells her her dreams. This leads to a breakout. This leads to all 19 people breaking out of captivity. And the entire book is this woman running from two separate entities. She's running with this knowledge of the code that she really doesn't know what these words mean, like scratch a straight line in the dirt because evil travels in, scratch a crooked line in the dirt because evil travels in straight lines and so forth. So she's traveling with these cryptic messages in her mind, not knowing whether or not to use them or what they mean and so forth. So as she unravels the meaning of these, of the code, she's on the run. And as she unravels, she goes a little bit further and a little bit further and a little bit further. And she's being pursued by two entities. She's being pursued by a slave stealer whose job in those days was to essentially just steal slaves and keep them captive and then sell them to traders who came up from New Orleans in the South. Because that was a problem in the northern part of the Dixie line of the South, especially in Baltimore and northern Virginia. Slave stealers would simply steal slaves, hide them, and then when slave ships came up from the South, they would sell them cheaply to slave traders who took them to New Orleans, and they never were seen again. Liz is being pursued by one slave stealer named Patty Cannon, who's based on the real thing. There really was a Patty Cannon who lived in Reliance, Delaware, who really did steal slaves, and she stole many of them. And she was a notorious person who was feared by both whites and blacks. Liz is also being pursued by a fellow by the name of the Gimp, who is a waterman who was, in his day, was the most able slave catcher in Dorchester County and on the Chesapeake Bay. So these two separate entities, neither of whom likes each other. The Gimp doesn't like Patty Cannon. Patty Cannon doesn't like the Gimp. They're both pursuing this woman as she tries to make her way north. That is essentially the book. The book is really one long chase. And throughout the whole business of this chase, the deeper questions of what slavery was and what it represented and how it's presented is really what the book is about. And the reason why I wanted to write about slavery was because when I was, one reason why I wanted to write about slavery was when I was in South Africa. I'd been to Africa 3 times. And I remember when I was a younger, I'm still young, but younger, you know. I was listening to this jazz musician on WRTI. I can't remember who it was. And he said, he had been to Africa. I hadn't gone to Africa yet. And he said, "You know, South Africa reminds me more of the United States than any other place." And I said, "Well, now what does that, you know, that didn't seem to make sense to me, you know, at the time." Until I went to South Africa myself. And it did. It reminded me more of the United States than any other place I'd ever been to. Partly because that whole business of apartheid and that whole business of racial separation was and still does exist both here and in South Africa. Yet we still managed to function and get along and so forth. And so my whole feeling about American racial issues and slavery and so forth is rooted in my own experience, in the sense that I see that we essentially live in two different worlds. We live in the world of, like, North Philly and then Center City. North Philly, if it's still the way I remember it, is basically, you know, poor black people who live in their own world, their own planet. And then Center City, or, you know, Rittenhouse Square, is another area where, you know, where there's a different type of, where different life goes on, you know, and hip-hop is the problem of all, you know, the root of all evil, and that's why we're in Iraq right now, because the hip-hoppers, you know, it just... So, what I found most intriguing about slavery was that, in my study of it, was that slavery was not so much... And I'm not an apologist for slavery, so don't, you know, if you have that on your heart, this ain't the place to debate it. But slavery really was about a web of relationships. It was much more, it wasn't so much that, you know, of course it was based on the whole business of superiority, inferiority, and so forth. But the web of relationships that slavery represented was very, very intricate. So that, for example, in the case of, in the book, for example, you have one slave who wants to run away. He knows he's planned it out for months and months, but he knows if he leaves that his mistress, his owner, will likely lose her farm. And if she loses her farm, that means his nephew and his sister will likely be sold to the South. So he's back and forth about it because he knows he needs to be free. He can't live unless he's free. Yet his freedom will mean the sacrifice of a mistress who has been very kind to him, the mistress's children who he loves. The mistress is a widow, and it means that his sister and his brother-in-law will be sold for the South. So it means the destruction of any life that he's ever known, and that's the price of freedom for him. So he's back and forth about whether to run or not. He's not sure. And that in his world enters this runaway slave, Liz, whom he falls in love with, and now his world is even twisted and turned upside down even more. The whole point of that whole business is that slavery was really about how deeply connected we are. And so for a slave to run away, or for a family that cared about their slave to sell that slave, it was kind of like ripping out part of your arteries. It was very difficult. And that's what happens when you sort of fold racism into the fabric of society, or you stitch racism into the socioeconomic fabric of society. So that's what Song Yet Sung is essentially about in a deeper way. On a surface level, it's basically Pulp Fiction. You know, the lady's running, people trying to catch her, you know, they're shooting and killing and, you know, and all that stuff. Because when I read a novel, I don't want to read a novel like, you know. I mean, you know, with all due respect to Jane Austen, you know, Dominus Domino, you put. Yeah, I personally just don't want to spend, you know, read 8 pages describing a leaf and, you know, and characters. Or, you know, they say, you know, are we having tea? When they really mean, you know, I hate your girl. I can't. I also think that, you know, times have changed in terms of writing fiction, particularly literary fiction. It's really hard to connect with audiences who can get instant gratification from television, particularly the young people. So, as a writer, you want to kind of just get to the business, what needs to be done, state your business, get your characters up and moving around, and then let your reader decide if the movement of the characters is to their liking. So that's what Song Yet Sung is about. Spike Lee wants to make that into a movie as well. We've already started that process. And his big concern is he's not sure people will sit in their seats to in a 2-hour movie to really hear about slavery. But the good news is that Song Yet Sung isn't really about slavery. It's really about the web of relationships that existed during that time. In many ways, they're very similar to the web of relationships that exist now. We still, all of us, most of us, live in that comfort zone where we try to push the collective good forward. But if it means selling that SUV, well, I don't know. I got a lot of stuff and, you know, I mean, how am I going to get my kids to school? And, you know, I really need that Hummer, you know. So that's what Song Yet Sung is about. In general, most of my work, all of my work, including my latest book, which I just started, is really about the commonality of the human experience and how we as human beings have to find, how we, when we find that common ground, it makes us better people. I suppose in the long run, I could just keep writing the same book over and over, you know, The Color of Water Part 2 and Part 3. I mean, Maya Angelou did that. She's written an autobiography in like 5 volumes or something. I can't think of that much to say about myself. But I just can't write the same book again and again. But the underlying themes of my work are driven by what most people of color in the society feel, and that is that what we are on the outside really is just irrelevant. We're very sophisticated at dealing with it. Black people are, and to some degree, other, you know, Asian and Latino people as well, but particularly black people. We're very, very good at negotiating amongst society, knowing that we will not really be truly understood all the way through. And that's just life. That's just part of it. As a parent, you know, it's difficult to kind of give that message to your kids, particularly nowadays when they see, you know, they think everything's cool. They think it's all, you know, all well and good. But my point is that my work deals with the commonality of the human experience. We are not that different. We are much more alike than we are different. The sooner we come to that understanding, I think the better off that we will be collectively. And so ends my spoken part of my presentation. And now I'll open the floor to any questions that you have about anything, about the writing process, you know, about any of my books, about novel writing, fiction, nonfiction. Okay, well, I have the privilege of calling on you, so I get to call on you, and then you can, you know. Well, there it is. There are no takers, and that's what I like about Philly. Yes, sir.
Oh, it's cool. You still play alto?
I play tenor and alto, but mostly tenor these days. Yeah, I still play some music. I do about maybe 10 or 12 dates a year. I'm doing a big date in Philly on November 20th or something like that for the AIDS Law Project here. Myself, Jonathan Demme, hopefully Denzel Washington. I do that every year. AIDS Law Project, one of the best things this city has got going for it, really. It's a unique organization that defends AIDS victims for free. And some of the stories that you hear that some of these lawyers have to deal with are just really heartbreaking. And I suppose I have a connection to the AIDS business, partly because I went to Oberlin. And a lot of my friends had died because, you know, during the 80s, especially the great plague years, many of whom were gay. So I have a kind of a special connection. In fact, the Song Yet Sung is dedicated to a friend of mine named Moses Hogan, who was a great, really great musician, an Oberlin Conservatory graduate. And he ran this wonderful choir, Negro Spiritual Choir. They used to sing spirituals. And you can still find his work on the web. It's just wonderful stuff. And I should mention that the Negro spirituals that Moses participated in putting together, a lot of that work is in Song Yet Sung as well. Because a lot of people who feel that the code didn't exist when you're talking about black Americans, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, there was no secret code that black people used. In fact, there was a guy in the New York Times, he was like page one story, you know, some guy from Yale, you know, got himself on page one of the New York Times screaming about there was no code during slavery. Well, I think there was a code. First of all, my book is nonfiction. I mean, my book is fiction, so it doesn't matter. But just, I'm pretty sure there was a code. I mean, I grew up in the black church. The songs that we sang in black church, for those of you who grew up in the black church, were all about slavery. I'm a soldier. I'm a soldier of the Lord. We will break bread together on our knees. Wade in the water. I mean, that's an easy one. Wade in the water. But God's going to trouble the water. Because if you waded in the water, the dogs who followed you during slavery couldn't catch your scent. I mean, just dozens and dozens of songs that were or used during slavery time as communicative devices to allow people to pass messages on. I mean, there was no great big book like, you know, the code book, you know. That, yes, the Quakers have it now. It's the code book, and they use it too, you know. But there were messages and missives that slaves used, and those who helped them use to ferry one another to freedom. Well, the music, sure, yeah. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am, with the glasses. What kind of research did I do into the subject of slavery? In order to write this book? I read about 25 books. And I spent a lot of time down on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. A lot of time. And I did a lot of studying about watermen. I read a lot of, because a lot of Song Yet Sung involves the watermen who existed on the Eastern Shore. Watermen were very, very interesting people. They are like, in terms of toughness, in terms of grit, they make your Wild West cowboys look like choir boys from New England, really. Not that I dislike New England, but they were really, really hard people. They fished in the wintertime, and they farmed in the summer. The Eastern Shore of Maryland is like a bunch of grapes. And if you just imagine a bunch of grapes, if you imagine all the spaces between the grapes, that's where the water was on the Eastern Shore. It's all about water. And negotiating that water to get the oysters off the bottom of the Chesapeake Bay, which is rugged business, was really tough business for men and women. And so the watermen of the Eastern Shore were and are a breed unto themselves. So there was a guy named Fred Tilp, T-I-L-P, who wrote three books about the Eastern Shore, two of which I have, the third I can't find. And I heard his wife has another unpublished book that he wrote. I read several books by the writers of the Eastern Shore because my book takes place there. And in order to set that tableau properly, it was harder to get a grasp on the Eastern Shore than to get a grasp on slavery. Slavery was, you know, basically, you know, there's a lot of documentation, at least in terms of the, you know, who, what, where, when's, and why's. A little spare when it comes to talking with African-Americans. There are a lot of African-American accounts of slavery as well, enough to work with. But the whole business of the Eastern Shore during the 1850 to 1860 is not that much. Thomas Flowers, most of the book, Thomas Flowers, for example, wrote an unpublished book about the Eastern Shore. Most of the work I found on the Eastern Shore I found through the Chesapeake Bay Historical Society or something like that. I forgot the name of it. I think it was called the Cambridge Historical Society. Interestingly, when I went to the Eastern, E-A-S-T-O-N, Historical Society in Talbot County in Maryland, they were so snotty that I never went back. You know, they're just a bunch of snobs. You know these historical societies, and that's hit and miss. Sometimes you get the people and they're just gung ho, and then other times you just get just these yuppies, man, who don't know what they're doing. It's just all tea and crumpets. They're really not interested in history. They're just They're getting together, and then here you come, and you got questions, and what, Talking about black people, get out of here, We got this is the Historical Society. We don't talk about that, I'm not kidding you. But anyway, my job as a writer, by the way, is not to critique or criticize any historical society. I get the job done. However I need to get it done, I get it done. However I can get to the mainland, if I have to jump from lily pad to lily pad, I do it. I read the books, and I forget them almost instantly. I just read a book by Paul Mattoni. He wrote a book called Becoming a Man. It's about a gay man who basically came of age. It's a great book, really. It's just an extraordinary book. Paul Monette. It's just a great book, and I've forgotten it already. I mean, but I know enough to say that I just finished it yesterday. It was really well written. Part of the thing is that my thing is just amass the knowledge, and then as a writer, try to just let it become part of the Let it get into the system. Let it just bleed into the system. Paul Mattoni is a great writer. He died in 1995 of AIDS. And one of the reasons why I'm reading that book is one of my characters, my new book, is gay. That book has a lot of graphic sex. It's a little bit, you know. I think if I were an editor, I would take that book and make a G-rated version of it. Because it's really an important work, particularly now with a lot of these issues in terms of gay marriage and so forth. It's really quite a book, quite a writer. Anyway, I hope that answered your question. Yes, ma'am, with the white shirt?
Yes, welcome to Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love.
There it is.
I want to ask you, such a beautiful book that you have written. Have you taken the experiences of your saxophone and connected to your writings? I mean, I like the saxophone. You do not have to use words. You use the spirit and what comes from your soul for that experience. Have you done that?
I wish I could say I did, but I haven't. Partly because music is so hard to do. That when I know there's some writers who can't write without music, you know, and they use music, you know, I feel music in my heart, you know, I don't know what the hell, I mean, I just can't do that. It's so hard to do. It's so hard to play. It's so hard to be good as a musician that when I'm playing or writing music, I completely divorce myself from the writing part of my life. They're both very hard to do. I've only recently started practicing again, just recently, you know. And the older I get, the harder it is to practice. I mean, I'm more economy now. I mean, there's more kind. When you get old, as some of you, I mean, just a few of you, no. You know, you start to realize that there's just an economy involved in terms of how to get around and how to negotiate. You know, you no longer, you know, if you, you know. You don't need, you know, you don't really have to match your, you know, underpants with your socks. Well, you just get out the bed. Hey, it's working, you know. So, anyway, I don't use music that much in that way. Any other? Did you have a question in front of her? Yes? Go ahead, I'll repeat it.
I've found that a lot of times people of color who are in creative professions are forced to be representative of their entire race. Have you found that, and how have you combated it?
Well, I think it's true that you're forced to be representative of your entire race. That's just part of being a minority in America. I don't fight against it. I just go with it, you know. I mean, technically I'm Jewish, you know. How come my books aren't in the Judaic section of the bookstore, you know? I mean, how come Philip Roth and I can't be, you know, bookmates, you know? But, look, you know, I only have so many battles in me. I feel privileged that I can make a living as a writer. People like Zora Neale Hurston and others who are so much more talented than I am. You know, James Baldwin, you know, who really makes us all look like amateurs. You know, had to leave America. And he had so many rivers to cross because he was black, he grew up poor, he was gay. I confess that I've become a lot more sensitive, about as sensitive to the gay, quote unquote, question as I am to that of black people and Jewish people, in the sense that, we have so many problems in this country, and we are worrying about how people decide to spend their private time. I mean, how often do you have sex? Really? I mean, do you, like anybody who tells me who's they're married, they used to have sex like twice a week. I'm sure they're lying. They're not telling the truth. So I don't care what someone does in the privacy of their bedroom. I just care how they live and make this country function. I can remember gay school teachers, gay camp counselors, gay classmates, gay musicians with whom I've worked, and I cannot recall anyone ever, you know, saying, you know, trying to turn me on or, you know. I mean, we just have such misguided notions about what humanity is. We are wasting so much time. If you sit here and when Philip is done with you, if you sit here and you still feel the same way about gay people after he's finished talking, then you need to go see somebody. Because we have so much to do in this world. There's so much work to be done. And I don't care. My house is on fire and my children aren't in it. And I don't care who brings me water. So, you know, yeah, it's not really fair that my books end up in the black section. But I'm happy that they end up in the section, period. Yes, ma'am? We have one more question? One more question? Okay. I have no introduction to Judaism, really, other than knowing my mother's story. So I haven't presented myself as a person who is, you know, who's an expert on Judaism. Let me just, since they're the only, I know the only two Jewish people in the whole audience, but I'll just for those two Jewish people in the audience, let's just clear things up here. There's three. Okay, there's three. I don't care whether you're Jewish or not. It does not make you an extra special person to me. I don't care if you're black or Christian. It doesn't make you an extra special person to me. When I go back to Brooklyn, every year, they have the Old Timers Day in Red Hook in the housing projects. And the first year I went back, this was maybe 10 years ago, I saw this white lady walking around, not mommy, just some white lady walking around, and everybody knew who she was. And so I said to my godmother, I said, who is that? She said, oh, that's Carol such and such, a little Jewish lady. She said, she knows everybody in the projects. She said, she can walk around here. And she's, I used to brag my godmother. She used to say, you can walk around here any hour. She said, no, I can't walk around here any hour. She said, but she can, because she knows every single family in this housing projects. Now, that's a special kind of heaven for that woman. I don't know if it's a Jewish heaven or a Christian heaven, but there's a special kind of heaven for her. And so let it be said that it doesn't matter what you do and where you worship. It matters how you spend your time on God's planet now, today, taking care of business. Yes, sir, we're out of time, but go ahead. Well, there it is. Well, listen, before I go, I want to add that Philip is coming right behind me. I held his reading up, so I hope that you do him the service of hearing his latest work and also supporting his work, which in many ways is a lot more relevant to where we are right now today. Thank you very much for coming, and God bless you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.